A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, continuing with the first aid education thread, but this time on fire safety in high-rise apartment buildings, which, here in Israel, is basically everyone. He's asking what practical guidelines actually matter beyond the standard, don't use the elevator line, and he raises something specific I hadn't thought about in years, that in a building fire you might be effectively blind. Smoke does that, and that respiratory hazards can kill you long before flames ever reach your door. He also mentioned those escape hood products, and wants us to look at whether they're worth anything.
This is one of those topics where the gap between what people think they should do and what actually keeps you alive is enormous. And I say that as someone who spent decades drilling emergency protocols in a clinical setting. The principles transfer, but the details are wildly different.
Start with the thing most people get wrong.
Most people think you evacuate. In a high rise, that instinct can get you killed. The dominant fire safety doctrine for modern high rises, and this is backed by the NFPA, the National Fire Protection Association, and adopted in building codes across most developed countries, including Israel, is defend in place. The building is designed as a series of compartments. Your apartment is a fire-rated box. The walls, the floor, the ceiling, the front door, all rated to resist fire for a specified duration, typically 60 to 90 minutes in a building built to modern code. The idea is that the fire stays in the unit where it started, and everyone else stays put behind their rated doors.
The building does the work.
The building does the work. And this is the part that feels deeply counterintuitive because every instinct says get out. But if you're on the 18th floor and the fire is on the 6th, leaving your apartment means entering a stairwell that might already be filling with smoke, descending through the fire floor's landing, passing doors that other panicked residents might have propped open. You're moving toward the hazard.
That's the phrase I've seen. You're moving toward the hazard.
And fire stairwells in modern buildings are pressurized. There are fans that push air into the stairwell to keep smoke out. The system is designed for people to use it safely. But if someone on the fire floor panics and jams the stairwell door open, that pressurization fails. The stairwell becomes a chimney, and now everyone above that floor who decided to evacuate is trapped in a concrete tube filling with hot smoke.
The rule is, unless the fire is in your unit or you're told to evacuate by the fire department, you stay put.
That's the rule. And it's worth saying explicitly, if the fire is in your apartment, leave immediately, close the door behind you, do not lock it, just close it, and call the fire department from outside. That closed door can contain the fire to your unit for a significant amount of time. There's a UL Firefighter Safety Research Institute study that shows a closed door can mean the difference between 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit and 100 degrees in the adjacent room. It's not subtle.
A closed door is the cheapest piece of fire safety equipment you own.
The one nobody thinks about. People prop doors open for airflow, for convenience, for kids running between rooms. A closed bedroom door at night is one of the single most effective things you can do. I cannot overstate this.
Okay, so defend in place is the baseline doctrine. But Daniel's prompt gets at something else. The stuff that fire codes don't tell you. The practical, granular things. What do you actually do while you're defending in place?
Let's walk through it sequentially. Fire breaks out somewhere in the building. You become aware, either you hear an alarm, you smell smoke, a neighbor calls. First decision is the fire in your unit. Second action, call the fire department. Do not assume someone else has called. Everyone assumes someone else has called. Tell them your building address, your apartment number, what floor you're on, what you're experiencing. That information is gold to the incident commander. Seal your apartment. This is where the practical stuff that nobody talks about comes in. You need to prevent smoke infiltration. Smoke is the primary killer in structure fires. Not burns, not heat, smoke. Something like 60% of fire fatalities are from smoke inhalation, and the majority of those occur in rooms remote from the fire's origin.
The respiratory hazard Daniel mentioned.
So you seal. Wet towels or duct tape around the front door gaps. If you have a door sweep, great. If not, a rolled up towel works. Close all interior doors. Shut off the HVAC or air conditioning. Your building's ventilation system can pull smoke from the fire floor and distribute it through your vents. In Israel, a lot of apartments have those individual split-unit air conditioners rather than central air, which is actually better in this scenario because they're not pulling air from a central shaft. But still, turn them off.
What about windows?
This is nuanced. If there's no smoke outside your window, opening it slightly can help with fresh air. But if the fire is below you, smoke and flames can travel up the building facade. You've seen those videos of exterior fires racing up cladding. If you see smoke rising past your window, keep it shut and never break a window. You might need to close it again, and you can't unbreak glass.
The cladding point is worth pausing on. Israel had its own version of that concern, right?
After the Grenfell Tower fire in London in 2017, there was a lot of scrutiny on exterior cladding materials worldwide. Israel's building stock varies enormously by era. Buildings from the 70s and 80s are concrete boxes, not pretty, but excellent fire compartmentation. Some of the newer high-rises in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem have more complex facades. The Israeli fire code has been updated, but enforcement is uneven. I wouldn't say it's a crisis, but it's a variable worth knowing about.
You've sealed your apartment. You've called the fire department. Now, you wait.
You wait, but not passively. You stay low. Smoke rises. The air at floor level can be breathable even when the air at standing height is lethal. If you have kids, this is where things get specific and, honestly, a little scary to think about.
Let's go there. Daniel and Hannah have Ezra. A lot of listeners have small children. What's different?
The biggest thing is that you have to practice. Kids don't respond to verbal instructions in an emergency unless they've rehearsed them. And the rehearsal has to be calm and repeated, not scary, just matter of fact. If we hear the fire alarm, we stay in the apartment. We go to this room. We sit on the floor. Make it a game if they're very young, but they need to know the plan exists.
You need to be able to find them in the dark.
Or in the smoke. Which brings us to one of Daniel's specific points, that you might be effectively blind. He's right. Smoke can reduce visibility to zero within seconds. If you've ever been in a structure fire simulation, and I have, it's disorienting in a way that's hard to describe. You lose spatial awareness almost immediately. You can't see your hand in front of your face.
What's the practical response to that?
First, know your apartment's layout by feel. You should be able to navigate from any room to any other room with your eyes closed. Korn, close your eyes right now and walk from your bed to the front door. Can you do it without touching anything unexpected?
I would absolutely stub my toe on something.
Most people would. But in a fire, that's not a comedy moment. It's lost time and potential injury. It sounds absurd, but it's free, and it takes 30 seconds. Keep a flashlight somewhere you can find it in the dark. Not your phone. Your phone might not be next to you, and the flashlight app requires unlocking the phone and swiping. A dedicated flashlight, ideally one that lives in the same spot all the time. For families with kids, put one in the kids' room too, at a height they can reach.
Phone as flashlight is one of those things that sounds fine until you're disoriented at 3 in the morning.
And speaking of phones, keep it charged. If you're sealed in your apartment waiting for rescue, your phone is your lifeline to the fire department. They may call you to get updates on your location and condition. A dead phone in that scenario is genuinely dangerous.
All right, let's move to the thing Daniel said he thinks is unnecessary, but worth discussing.
Respiratory protective escape devices, technically. These are hoods you pull over your head that filter out carbon monoxide and particulates, giving you something like 15 to 60 minutes of breathable air in a smoke-filled environment. They're sold for home use. Prices range from about $40 to $200 depending on the model.
Daniel's instinct is that they're overkill.
I think his instinct is mostly right, but let me give the nuanced version. For the typical defend-in-place scenario in a modern high-rise, an escape hood is solving a problem you shouldn't have. If you're staying in your sealed apartment, you shouldn't be in an environment where you need one. The hood becomes relevant only if you're evacuating through smoke, which, as we've established, you generally shouldn't be doing.
It's a product that incentivizes the wrong behavior.
That's one concern. There's a psychological dimension here. If you own an escape hood, you might feel more confident evacuating through smoke than you should be. The hood becomes a permission structure for bad decisions. And I don't say that dismissively. I understand the appeal. It feels like agency in a situation where you otherwise have very little.
What about the hoods themselves? Do they work?
The tested ones do work within their stated parameters. There are European standards, EN403, that certify these devices for carbon monoxide filtration and particulate removal. A certified hood will protect your airways for its rated duration. But, and this is a big but, they don't protect against heat. They don't give you oxygen if the environment is oxygen depleted. They don't protect the rest of your body. And they require you to be able to don them correctly under extreme stress, which is not nothing.
Donning under stress. That's the thing that trips people up with all kinds of safety equipment.
There's a reason flight attendants demonstrate the oxygen mask every single flight, and people still mess it up in actual emergencies. An escape hood has to be removed from its packaging, which is designed to be tamper-evident and airtight for shelf life, so it's not easy to open. You have to pull it over your head, ensure the seal is correct, make sure your hair isn't breaking the seal. All while your smoke alarm is screaming, you can't see, and your heart rate is through the roof.
If you have kids, you're now trying to do this for them too.
Which is where the family scenario really complicates things. An adult can theoretically don a hood in 30 seconds with practice. A terrified 3-year-old, you're not getting a hood on them quickly, if at all. And most families don't buy hoods for every member. They buy one or two. So now you're making decisions about who gets the hood while the clock is ticking. That's not a scenario I want any parent to face.
If someone's serious about preparedness and wants to buy something, what should they buy instead?
That's the unsexy answer, but it's the one that saves lives. Most fire fatalities occur in homes without working smoke alarms. A smoke alarm in every bedroom, in the hallway outside sleeping areas, and on every level of the home. In Israel, the standard is less rigorous than what I just described. Many apartments have one alarm, if any. This is a $20 device that gives you time, and time is everything.
What about fire extinguishers?
Worth having, with caveats. A small kitchen extinguisher, rated for Class A, B, and C fires, can stop a small fire before it becomes a big one. But you need to know how to use it, and you need to know when not to use it. If the fire is larger than a wastebasket, don't fight it. If there's significant smoke, don't fight it. If you're not sure you could put it out in 5 seconds, don't fight it. And always position yourself with your back to an exit when using an extinguisher. Never let the fire get between you and the way out.
The 5-second rule is a good heuristic. If you can't knock it down in 5 seconds, you're not fighting the fire anymore. The fire is fighting you.
And I'd add, if you do buy an extinguisher, take it outside once and actually discharge it briefly. Feel what the trigger is like, how the stream behaves. Most people have never used one until the moment they need to, and that's a terrible time to learn.
There's a broader point here about the preparedness industry. A lot of products are sold to people who want to feel prepared without doing the unsexy work of planning and practice.
The escape hood is the poster child for that. It's a tangible object you can buy, put in a closet, and feel like you've done something. But real preparedness is procedural. It's having a family meeting point outside the building. It's knowing your building's fire safety features. Does your stairwell have pressurization? Where are the fire extinguishers on your floor? Is your front door self-closing? It's checking that your door sweeps are intact and your windows open properly. None of that costs $200.
Let's talk about the building itself. Daniel mentioned that high-rises have advanced fire suppression infrastructure. What should people actually know about their building systems?
Modern high-rises have several layers: sprinklers, standpipes for fire department hoses, pressurized stairwells, fire alarms with voice evacuation capability, smoke control systems. But here's the thing. All of these systems require maintenance, and maintenance requires functional building governance. In a condo or a rental building with an attentive management company, those systems get tested and maintained. In a building where the Va'ad Bayit, the resident committee, can barely agree on stairwell cleaning, they probably don't.
The Va'ad Bayit is doing a lot of heavy lifting in Israeli apartment life.
It really is. And fire safety is one of those invisible things that nobody wants to spend money on until it's too late. I'd say to any listener, find out when your building's fire systems were last inspected. Ask to see the report. If there's resistance to that request, that itself is information.
What about older buildings? Israel has plenty of those.
Older buildings are a mixed picture. A concrete building from the 1970s has excellent inherent fire resistance. Concrete doesn't burn, and the compartmentation is often better than in newer buildings where open-plan design and service penetrations create hidden pathways for smoke. But older buildings may lack sprinklers, may not have pressurized stairwells, may have electrical systems that haven't been updated in decades. Electrical fires are one of the leading causes of residential fires, and old wiring is a major risk factor.
The building's age cuts both ways.
And this is where individual awareness becomes critical. You can't control your building's wiring, but you can control whether you overload outlets, whether you use space heaters safely, whether you leave candles unattended. Most residential fires start with human behavior, not building system failures.
Let's circle back to something Daniel raised that we touched on, but haven't fully addressed. The blindness problem. Smoke, as a visual obstruction. What else should people know about navigating in zero visibility?
A few things. First, stay low. We said that, but it bears repeating. The air at floor level can be survivable even when the air at head height is toxic. Crawl if you need to move. Second, use the back of your hand to feel walls and doors, not your palm. If you touch a hot surface with your palm, your reflex is to grip, which means you're now gripping a hot surface. The back of your hand triggers a withdrawal reflex. This is a small thing that firefighters are trained to do.
That's the kind of granular detail that nobody tells you. What about finding doors?
In zero visibility, you navigate by feel along walls, counting doorways. This is why knowing your apartment layout by touch matters. If you're trying to reach a child's room and you know it's the second door on the left from your bedroom, you can count door frames with your hand. Before opening any door, check it with the back of your hand. If the door or the doorknob is hot, do not open it. There's fire on the other side.
If you do open a door and there's smoke behind it,
close it immediately. The closed door is your friend. We keep coming back to this.
What about windows as an exit? When is that the right call?
Almost never in a high-rise above the second or third floor. Do not jump. Do not attempt to climb down the exterior. Do not tie bedsheets together. That works in movies, not in real life. Your apartment is safer than the exterior of the building. The only exception is if the fire is inside your apartment and you can't reach the front door and you're on a low floor. Even then, hanging from a windowsill and dropping is preferable to jumping.
The bedsheet thing is one of those cultural myths that's going to get someone killed.
It really is. The knot-tying skill required to create a rope that will hold an adult's weight is not something most people possess. And even if you do, the sheet material isn't rated for that load. It's a desperation move from an era before modern fire codes, and it has no place in a contemporary safety plan.
Let's talk about fire drills. Not the office building kind, the at-home kind. Are they worth doing?
And I think the way to do them is low-key and scenario-based. Don't make it a big dramatic production, especially with kids. But once or twice a year, say, okay, let's pretend the smoke alarm just went off. What do we do? Walk through it. Check that everyone knows the meeting point outside. Check that everyone knows to stay low. Check that the kids know not to hide. Kids hide in fires. It's a well-documented phenomenon. They get scared and they crawl under the bed or into a closet. You need to explicitly teach them not to do that.
How do you teach a small child not to hide without terrifying them?
You frame it positively. If you hear the alarm, you come find me. You're my helper. I need to know you're safe. Make them feel like they have a job. Kids respond to having a role much better than they respond to a list of prohibitions.
That's useful.
For adults, the drill is about testing your assumptions. Can you actually find your flashlight in the dark? Does your front door open smoothly, or does it stick? Are your windows painted shut? These are things you discover in a drill that you can fix on a normal Tuesday afternoon.
What about go bags? The preparedness community loves go bags.
For fire specifically, I'm less enthusiastic about go bags than I am for, say, earthquake preparedness. In a fire, time is measured in seconds. You don't want to be gathering belongings. The only things worth grabbing, and only if they're immediately accessible, are your phone, your keys, shoes, and a jacket if it's cold. Everything else is replaceable. Your life isn't.
Shoes are an underrated one. People evacuate barefoot, and then they're standing on broken glass or hot asphalt.
Keep a pair of sturdy shoes under your bed. It's a small thing that can make a big difference. In Israel, where a lot of people wear sandals or go barefoot indoors, it's especially relevant.
Let's shift to something Daniel didn't explicitly ask about, but that I think is worth covering. What happens after the fire? The recovery side.
Smoke damage is pervasive in ways people don't anticipate. Even a small fire in a neighboring apartment can leave your belongings coated in soot and smelling of smoke for months. Renter's insurance or homeowner's insurance is essential, and you need to check that your policy covers smoke damage specifically. Some policies in Israel have exclusions or limitations.
The psychological side?
A building fire is a traumatic event, even if nobody is physically injured. Kids especially can develop anxiety about sleeping, about alarms, about being separated from parents. It's worth being aware of that and addressing it directly rather than hoping it goes away. Talk about what happened. Normalize the feelings. If the anxiety persists, get professional help. This is not a minor thing.
To synthesize the practical guidelines, because Daniel asked for basic guidelines, and we've covered a lot of ground, let me try to condense this into something actionable.
Go for it.
1. If the fire is not in your apartment, stay put. Defend in place. Your apartment is a fire-rated box designed to protect you. 2. Call the fire department yourself. Give them your exact location. 3. Seal your front door with wet towels or tape. Turn off air conditioning. Close all interior doors. 4. Stay low. Keep a dedicated flashlight accessible. Know your apartment layout by feel. 5. Do not use the elevator, obviously, but also don't rush to the stairwell unless instructed. The stairwell might be compromised. 6. Practice with your family. Kids need to know the plan, and they need to know not to hide. 7. Working smoke alarms are more valuable than any specialized equipment you can buy. Test them monthly.
That's a solid list. I'd add an 8th. Know your building. Find out when its fire systems were last inspected. Know where the stairwells are. Know if they're pressurized. Know if your building has sprinklers. This isn't obscure technical knowledge. It's information that shapes your decisions in an emergency.
Number 9. A closed door is the cheapest, most effective fire safety tool you own. Close your bedroom door at night.
Especially with kids. A closed door can keep a hallway fire out of a child's bedroom long enough for firefighters to arrive. The data on this is overwhelming.
All right. Let's return to the escape hood question and give it a definitive answer. Because Daniel asked us to look at it. Are they worth buying?
For the vast majority of people living in modern high-rises, no. The scenario where an escape hood is the right tool, evacuating through a smoke-filled environment, is a scenario you should be avoiding entirely through defend in place. The hood doesn't change the fundamental calculus. It adds cost, complexity, maintenance requirements. They have shelf lives, usually 3 to 5 years, and a false sense of capability.
Are there any edge cases where you'd recommend one?
If you live in an older high-rise without modern compartmentation, without sprinklers, without pressurized stairwells, a building where defend in place is less reliable, then an escape hood might be a reasonable addition to your kit. But even then, it's a distant second to making sure you have working smoke alarms and a practice plan. The hood is a last resort tool, not a primary strategy.
If someone does buy one, what should they look for?
Look for EN403 certification. That's the European standard for filtering respiratory protective devices for escape from fire. It certifies that the hood filters carbon monoxide, hydrogen cyanide, hydrogen chloride, acrolein, and particulates. Don't buy an uncertified hood from a random online seller. Practice donning it. Buy a training version if the manufacturer offers one. And understand its limitations. It doesn't make you fireproof, it doesn't give you oxygen, and it doesn't protect against heat.
The verdict is, not unnecessary in the absolute sense, but unnecessary for the scenario most people are actually preparing for.
The problem they solve is real. Smoke inhalation kills. But the solution for a high-rise resident is staying behind a sealed door, not buying a hood and walking through smoke.
One more thing I want to touch on. Daniel mentioned that respiratory hazards might be just as much of a threat as the fire itself. That's actually underselling it.
Smoke is the primary killer. Fire produces carbon monoxide, which binds to hemoglobin 200 times more readily than oxygen does. You can lose consciousness without ever realizing you're in danger. Hydrogen cyanide is produced when synthetic materials burn. Furniture, carpets, electronics. It's a cellular asphyxiant. The combination can incapacitate you in seconds. And this is why the defend-in-place strategy exists in the first place. It's not about protecting you from flames, it's about keeping you out of the smoke.
Which loops back to sealing the door. Wet towel, duct tape, whatever you have. It's not theater. It's keeping those gases out.
And for listeners who want to go a step further, you can buy door seal kits that include a silicone sweep for the bottom and adhesive strips for the frame. They're marketed for energy efficiency, but they double as smoke barriers. $20, permanent installation, works even when you're not home.
That's the kind of dual-purpose preparedness I like. It's not sitting in a closet waiting for an emergency. It's improving your apartment right now.
And I think that's the broader philosophy I'd want listeners to take away. The best fire safety measures are the ones that are already in place, already working, every single day. A closed bedroom door, a working smoke alarm, an apartment door that closes firmly. These aren't emergency measures, they're just how you live.
When the emergency comes, you're not scrambling to implement a plan. You're already living inside it.
That's the goal.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early medieval period, chroniclers in Vanuatu recorded that a single cosmic ray air shower can generate a cascade of over 10 billion secondary particles across an area exceeding 10 square kilometers.
I'm trying to imagine a medieval chronicler in Vanuatu writing that down, and I'm coming up short.
I have several questions, none of which I'm going to ask.
So here's the forward-looking thought I want to leave listeners with. We've talked about individual preparedness, but there's a collective dimension to fire safety in high-rises that we've only brushed against. Your safety depends on your neighbors. Their smoke alarm, their unattended cooking, their decision about whether to prop open the stairwell door. In a dense apartment building, fire safety is a shared responsibility, and that's uncomfortable because you can't control other people. The best thing you can do, beyond your own preparation, is to be a good neighbor. Know who lives next door. Know if they're elderly, if they have mobility issues, if they have small children. In an emergency, that knowledge might be the difference.
That's well said. And I'd add, if your building doesn't have a fire safety plan, pushing for one, through the Va'ad Bayit, through the management company, through whatever governance structure exists, is one of the most impactful things you can do. It's not as satisfying as buying a gadget, but it protects everyone.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, for keeping this operation running. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you found this useful, share it with someone who lives in a tall building.
Which, around here, is basically everyone.
See you next time!
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.